Welcome to another podcast by Air Insight.
This is Anderson Schoenland, and today is August the 1st, 2019. My guest today is David Neeleman, who generally would require no introduction, but it's good to know that he has founded four airlines, Morris Air, WestJet, JetBlue, and Azul in Brazil. And he's also the co-owner of TAP Air Portugal. David, that must put you in a very small club. Is there anybody else in the industry who's started so many airlines?
I think not that I can think of that personally was involved, you know, from the very beginning. You know, Bill Franke and his Indigo partners have funded a lot of airlines, and they provide a lot of support. But as far as kind of starting from zero, being on the ground floor, writing the business plan, raising the money, you know, I'm probably pretty rarefied air, I would say.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun.
Very, very impressive. So my first question for you is about TAP. It's basically reinvented itself with an aggressive expansion and fleet plan. It is now the largest operator of the 330neo. Can you tell us about the airplane, the service improvements, and the expansion plans using this airplane?
Sure. And, you know, let me just go back a little bit to the beginning of the privatization. You know, TAP was in a very difficult position. They had been owned by the government of Portugal since 1974. There was a coup at that time, and the airline was nationalized, and it had been part of the government, 100% owned by the government since that time. And then as Portugal joined the EU, you know, there were several regulations that were in the EU that dealt with state aid, you know, and just in a nutshell basically said if you're a state-owned company, you can't receive money from the government. You need to generate enough cash flow to sustain yourself, and if you can't do that, then you're going to suffer penalties. Because they didn't want, obviously, state-owned companies competing against private enterprise companies, which obviously was a smart move. So TAP had kind of limped along in this state where they weren't generating enough capital. They had lost years. They had, you know, good years. They actually bought Varig's old maintenance operation in Brazil, which caused them a lot of losses, and those losses pretty much offset any profits they made at the airline. So when, you know, kind of fast forward to 3 years ago when we were asked to come and consider the privatization, you basically had an airline that had a fleet of the oldest aircraft, you know, in Europe. You know, they had an Airbus fleet, but they had 340s and old 330s. The product was very bad. On seven of the airplanes of the wide bodies, you had the old cassette tape, so you'd, you know, plug it in back in the station, and everybody'd have to watch the same movie. It was, you know, nothing, no lay flat seats, nothing. So the narrow body fleet was old. The Portugalia, which was the wholly owned subsidiary, was flying F-100s and 145s. Average age was over 24 years of those aircraft. So it was in really bad shape. When we came in and made the investment, the first day we sent out $90 million just to make payroll, €90 million just to make payroll to pay the airport so they wouldn't repossess the airplanes. It was in really, really tough shape. So, you know, it's been a great, and you know, I always tell a story where on the first day where we were introduced to the employees, you know, the people who had put their heart and soul in that company. I was in this really cavernous, huge cafeteria. Over 1,000 people in there, and you know the enormity of that task and the importance of it for not only obviously for Portugal but for those people that had worked there, you know, some of them over 50 years. It just took a huge, you know, the responsibility was enormous. So we hired a great team of people, and they, you know, went about redesigning the network. You know, the first thing we did is made sure we defended the Lisbon hub. You know, the Ryanair and EasyJet had infiltrated, and TAP had just basically backed away from them, let them just take over, you know, and, you know, whatever they wanted. And, you know, we said, look, if we can't defend Portugal, we're dead anyway, so we need to make sure that we take over this airport again. So we had a lot of flights. We, you know, took over the rest of the slots. We went back. We were, I think, probably approaching 40% of the travelers, and now we're now over, you know, getting close to 60%. So we're back as the dominant player in Portugal, which we should be. The fleet renewal has been enormous. And you know, the deliveries from Airbus have been coming late, which you know we're probably a year behind schedule from where we should be from new planes. But basically, we get 330-900 as you mentioned, that has 30 more seats than our 330-200s. But more importantly, there are 50 more premium economy seats and 13 more business class seats on board, so we can all the business class seats, of course, are lay flat. Business class seats are the latest and greatest technology. And so our product has gone from, you know, basically the worst in Europe to the best in Europe. And that renewal is going on right now. We're going to get 19 330-900s. I think we're up to 11 or 12 right now. So through the end of this year and into 2020, we'll have that fleet completely. The 340s will be gone. The oldest 330-200s will be gone. We'll keep seven 330-200s that have been refurbished and retrofit with lay-flat business class seats. We've got some NEOs coming in, some 321 NEOs and some 320 NEOs. But probably the most important addition, I think, is 321 LR. The 321 LR, is a bit of a disappointment for anyone else in Europe, except for if you're in Lisbon. The range on that airplane was supposed to, you know, be over 4,000 miles and end up being, you know, under 4,000 miles. So it really didn't work for any other mainland European hub except for Lisbon, because we're so far out of the Atlantic. So with that airplane, we can fly to northeastern Brazil. We can fly to northeastern United States. You know, basically, if you look at any area between Washington, D.C. and all the way north to Toronto and anywhere in between, we can hit from Lisbon with that airplane. And the same goes for Brazil, from Belém all the way down to Maceió and all the cities in between. So it's a plane that gives us about 50% lower trip costs. So if we take costs as 100,000 euros to fly a flight, now it costs us 50. And our seat mile cost, the actual cost per seat, has actually dropped 15%. So, you know, obviously we don't care as much cargo, but, you know, cargo is not important in a lot of the markets we fly. So it's a real game-changer airplane. And we've got only two of those now. We have 12 more on their way in. Hopefully have those by the end of next year, if we can get them, you know, out of Hamburg. And so that has been a great transformation story. And I've spent a lot of time recently looking at our airplane operating margins, and you know, comparing a 200 A330-200 to a 900, you know, up at least 5 margin points. You know, looking at LR 321 LR routes compared to 330 routes, up about 10 or 12% margin points, and then 321s. Our 321 NEOs, if you can believe this, actually with 220 seats on it, burn less fuel than our 319s with 147 seats on it. So that is a tremendous advantage for us. It gives us costs to compete vigorously with Ryanair and with EasyJet or Wizz or anybody else who wants to come to our market. We can defend it, and with a great product, with a great support staff, a great flight crews, you know, one of the safest airlines in the world, very professional flight crews, you know, from our in-flight crews. So we're excited about it. We're just partly the way there. I mean, of these new generation aircraft, this year will be about 25%. We'll finish this year, and then just looked at the numbers for 2024, we'll be over 90% of all of our ASKs will be with new generation airplanes. Even at Portugalia, where we're flying the E190, we'll have E2s, 195. So that's really going to be great as well. So we're excited about it. It's a great company. It's a great country. Very dedicated people. And so many people now are discovering Portugal that had never discovered it before, because for the first time we have service. We have cities, you know, North American cities you can serve and go to Portugal. And so people are loving Portugal. It's a fabulous place.
David, before we move on from the whole Airbus story here, the 321 XLR, you seem to have been... You've spoken in favor of that airplane. What do you see about this airplane's potential?
Well,
if you like the LR, what does the XLR do for you?
It's interesting because the XLR is needed. You know, what's incredible for me is that Airbus basically what they're doing, the principal difference between the LR and the XLR is they're basically taking out three bladder tanks that are in the X and the LR and replacing that with a permanent tank. Now, don't ask me why that's taking 4 years to do. I mean, I can't figure it out. You know, 4 years. You should be able to build a whole airplane in 4 years. But they're taking it. So, it's more unfortunate for everyone else than it is for us. You know, on the margin, that plane, the XLR, can get us to Salvador, Brazil, which is south of Maceió, and it could get us to, say, Chicago. But incrementally, it doesn't give us as much as it would, say, somebody, you know, like Air France, who has, you know, a hub in Paris, or even maybe, you know, Lufthansa for Frankfurt, where they can actually hit, you know, some cities in the U.S. But because, you know, we're 3 hours and 45-minute flight time going in a kind of a southwesterly direction from Frankfurt. So we are way out. I always say we're 3 hours from Frankfurt and 6 hours from Boston. You know, so we're kind of a third the way to the United States. We're so far. You know, and I think Iceland Air and Aer Lingus have those same advantages, but we do it, you know, to the southern Europe, as opposed to them to the northern tier, which the southern, you know, countries have a lot of attraction, especially in the wintertime. So XLR needed, should be coming quicker. On the margin, it doesn't really benefit us nearly as much as it maybe some of the other guys, because the LR does really nothing for anyone unless you're, you know, Aer Lingus or you know, maybe you know, British Airways in the British Isles, and you know, some of those places. But other than that, we're happy with the LR, and we'll get some XLRs when they come. But in the meantime, we'll have our 14 LRs, and we'll be doing a lot of stuff with them.
Okay, if I can switch gears now to Azul, you're the launch customer for the E2, the E195. What are your thoughts on Azul's expansion strategy, long-term vision, and the fleet plan? Whatever you can share with us.
Sure. You know, I mean, similar story. When we started Azul, if you can believe this, the total number of domestic travelers in Brazil the year before we started, in 2007, I think it was, 2008, there were 47 million people that were traveling domestically. Now, I think in that same year in the United States, there were 750 million people. Now, the United States has 300 million people and a much stronger economy and a higher per capita income. But Brazil has 200 million people. So that number just seemed like it needed to be a lot higher. And so we did our investigation, and we looked into it, and we, you know, kind of dug through all the reasons why. And we came up with two principal reasons. Number one was that airfares were extremely high in Brazil, but that time about twice as high as they were in the United States. And some justifiably so. Some costs in Brazil are higher, like fuel is about 50% higher than what they have in the United States. And then there was, this is not, because you had a duopoly operating in the country, there just wasn't service between a bunch of cities. You know, between the 25 largest cities in Brazil, you could only go nonstop about 20% of the time. You know, which meant 80% of the time you had to make connections. And that was just kind of a product of a duopoly and, you know, airlines not being innovative and using one type of aircraft that didn't allow them to, you know, fly between cities that deserve to have. You know, we had cities that have 3 million people and another city with 5 million people and no nonstop service. So that was kind of crazy. So we thought if we came in with a lower trip cost airplane, and we were starting to fly, and we flew a lot of these routes that, you know, weren't being served, that we could stimulate a lot of demand, and we could, you know, lower the fares. And the other thing that they were doing is they weren't really segmenting fares. There wasn't really a very big difference between the highest and the lowest fare. They were just all high, and there was, if you bought it today or you bought it 6 months from now, it was kind of the same fare. So we segmented the fares. We created a 21-day advance purchase fare that was the bus fare, basically. We said, look, if you want to plan advance, you can go for the bus fare. If you, you know, came closer in, you'd pay more if you were a business traveler. Just simple stuff that we had learned, you know, obviously in the United States, which had been practiced for a long time. So as we did this, we started expanding into markets and flying flights, and you know, we got the Embraer 195. it was doing great. And then we thought, wait a second. And there was another airline called Trip that was flying ATRs. And there was a lot of cities that we couldn't reach because even the trip cost of the 195 was relatively high compared to some of these cities. So we looked at it, and where we had like a 30% trip cost advantage to the 737s and the A320s, the ATR had a 40% trip cost advantage to our 195s, which obviously made, you know, anything Golden Town was doing prohibitive. It just no way they could hit these cities. So we went and got an order and ordered some ATRs and started flying those. And then we started running up against Trip a little bit, and we decided to get together. And so we merged, and you know, and with that Trip acquisition came a lot of new cities and a lot of things that we weren't doing. And you know, so today, and then what we noticed is that because we had so much flow traffic, we were, you know, in over 100 cities. We were approaching, you know, 900 flights a day. That we really were bottlenecked on a lot of our stuff. And as good as the Embraer 195 was on kind of hour and a half, 2 hour, up to 2 hour stage lengths, it didn't do well once you got past 2 hours because of the cost. The fuel burn per seat, you know, started to eat up as you started going above 2 hours. And then we looked at the, you know, the 320 Neos, and we said, wait, this airplane burns the same fuel as a 195 burns. So on a 3 or 4 hour stage length, that plane would work awesome. So we waited for the Neos there. We didn't jump the gun and get any COs. We just got Neos. And so we got a bunch of Neos, and then we basically were picking up 52 additional seats or 56 additional seats for essentially what was the same trip cost as a 195, which really boosted our margins and opened up, you know, pipes where we could actually, you know, between really, you know, Fortaleza and you know, our home base, Viracopos, we could put a bigger airplane on and it would lower our cost. We could charge lower fares. We had more seats, which helped all of our other flights that were feeding into it. So today, I think we're going to end the year with 40 320 Neos. We're getting some 321s. And, you know, we've just built an airline that this year will fly, you know, approximately 25 million customers. So that number, that 47 million number that when we started, it's gone to about 100. And we created about half of those just by flying to cities nobody else flew to. You know, 70% of our routes have, you know, really have no nonstop competition. So we've really revolutionized air travel in Brazil, and obviously we've been rewarded by it. We've gone public. You know, our stock price is, you know, high. It's doing well. I think the market recognizes that we've really built a better mousetrap. And we have, you know, ATRs. We have 320s. We have 195s. And then what we're really excited about is this year the E2 is coming, the E2 195. And that's a game-changer airplane for us as well. Because it burns, it basically will give us the same seat mile cost as what we have on our 320 Neos, but because we have it at 136 seats, you'll have a lower trip cost, and it will allow us to do a lot more frequency in some of the markets we want to do, and 15% lower costs with 18 more seats. So it's going to be tremendous as well. So our margins just keep going up and up, and profitability keeps going up, and again, a great group of people down there built a great airline. I'm just so proud to be the founder, and now I'm kind of the executive chairman. But you know, day to day, John Rogerson, our CEO, runs the company, and along with our CFO and our chief revenue officer, Alex Malfitani, and Abhi Shah, they do a tremendous job, along with, you know, others in the management like Jason Ward, who runs customer service, and so we have you know, Flavio Costa, who's our COO. So great. Group of people, and our, you know, the Trip founder, Zé Mario, is still with us and working hard. He's the president of the holding company, and so it's good to have him on board too. So there's it's a great group.
Well, you've told me two disruptive stories now, which leads me to, I mean, I can't resist. I need to ask you whatever you can share with me about your next disruptive plan called Moxie. What can you tell us about that?
Well, okay, so Moxie, one thing that I think it's important, and that is that I just don't start airlines because I want to start an airline. I mean, I certainly wanted to get back to the United States. and do something. But, you know, it just, I didn't really see an opportunity. There was, you know, the all the legacy carriers had gone through extreme restructurings. They had all gone through bankruptcy. They had gotten rid of their legacy costs. They had the consolidation. They became very powerful. They controlled all of the popular airports, were basically taken. You couldn't get slots or gates. And so, you know, it's just like, okay, the United States would be great, and I think there's a great economy there, and people love to travel. But it's just, I don't see the opportunity. And so I just kind of let it go. And then as time went on, you know, costs of these big airlines that they had restructured started to go up. The contracts kicked in. You know, there's challenges. There's lack of pilots and all that. But you know, other than their costs going up, their planes started getting bigger and bigger because they had to cover the costs of the increasing pilot costs, their salaries, and so they started pulling out of smaller cities, and they started, you know, there's a whole, literally scores and scores of cities in the United States that if you want to fly anywhere, basically you have to fly to a hub, and if you fly to a hub, chances are they don't really care about leisure travel if you are flying to a hub. They're just basically putting you in a smaller airplane and taking care of the business traveler, charging $600 and saying, sorry, if you want to go for less. So, you know, I looked at several examples where, you know, you'd have to make a connection, you'd fly an hour, you'd make a connection that took you an hour and a half, you'd fly another 2 hours. You know, the total elapsed time was like 6 hours. The fares were high, and if you were just to fly those two cities nonstop, you could actually do that in an hour and a half, or, you know, 2 hours flight time, or two and a half. So, you know, I started to develop this thing that said, you know, I think we can get you there twice as fast and for half as much money. And, you know, is there a market if you can fly someone there to get someone there, you know, twice as fast and save them, you know, have them pay half as much? And the question is the market size big enough? Can you stimulate it? And, you know, I think we've literally looked at hundreds of markets, and there's a big list of cities that we think would work great. You know, so we decided to go with the 220. And the 220, what we like about that airplane is that it has, it's, you know, three characteristics that are, it has range, so we can do two cities that don't have nonstop service that are far apart. It can fly over 6 hours. It can also, it's conducive to mixed class. So if you want to put a large number of business class seats or lay flat seats in there, you could do that. If you wanted to go the long distance, it can, you know, actually fly up to 8 hours. If you wanted to go to Europe with it, if you wanted to fly from Florida to South America, or if you wanted to fly, you know, off anywhere in the West to Hawaii, so you could do all that stuff. So, you know, I think you just have to have maximum flexibility nowadays. You know, we're not building fixed objects. We're not building skyscrapers in downtown New York. We're basically have a mobile asset that has an enormous amount of flexibility that can do a lot of different things, a lot of things that, you know, maybe the big guys don't want to do or can't do because of their cost structures. So we're excited about it, but our first plane doesn't come until 2021. So we've got plenty of time to get ready you know, we'll start the certification process here pretty soon, and once we get it done, we'll get the first planes and be off and running.
Can I ask you one quick last question? When you looked at the requirements for the U.S. for the Moxie plan, what made you choose the 220 over the E2?
I think the range. The range was an important thing. You know, it was actually the range, number one, and it was the range, and it was also the mixed class to change the mixed class, because, you know, it had a 3-2 configuration. You could go 2-2, and you wouldn't have to change the overhead bins. If you go to 2-1, you know, on the Embraer, you'd have to change the overhead bins, which is expensive. You know, we basically have interchangeable planes that from the exit row forward, we can put in all coach seats, all lay flat seats. We can put in from the business class, I mean from the exit row forward, we can either put in 36 domestic first class seats with a 40-inch pitch. We can put in 22 lay flat seats, like similar to what they have Mint, you know, at JetBlue, or we can put in I think it's 50 coat sheets. So, you know, we have that flexibility. We can make that change in a day and a half. It's just seats. It's not structural or anything with it. So it just gives us a tremendous amount of flexibility. And then the range, David, you know, two is a great airplane. We have a lot of them coming at Azul, and we're very happy to be a launch customer. But it's not even a Transcon airplane, and we needed something that was at least a Transcon airplane.
David, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me on.
This recording is copyrighted by Air Insight.